Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Our Science podcast, bringing you a fresh dose of exciting science news from around the Royal Society. I'm Peter Gallimore.
And I'm Camilla Tam. This month we've got a physical science special for you. Coming up, we've got highlights from a number of recent events at the Royal Society. The topics range from the mysteries of symmetry in the universe to a new use for magnetic resonance imaging.
We start with a tiny particle that caused huge excitement when it was first detected last year. The discovery of the Higgs boson at the Large Hadron Collider was regarded as a monumental breakthrough in standard model physics. At a scientific discussion meeting at the Royal Society earlier this year, physicists came to discuss the history of CERN and their plans for the future.
We caught up with Professors Ginotti and Verdi, who talked to us about the last 30 years of experimenting and why the discovery may have generated more questions than it answered.
I am Fabiola Ginotti. I'm a research physicist at CERN, the European Centre for Particle Physics. And the meeting we are having here at the Royal Society today is to discuss the present status of the Large Hadron Collider, the physics results that this collider and the experiments taking data at the LHC have accomplished so far, and to look at the future. So we are in some sense revisiting the last 20-25 years of work to make this project successful, in particular, you know, awarded already by very important discovery, the discovery of the Higgs boson, and then looking into the future and where does this lead us.
So since the main big discoveries last year, has this affected your research plans a lot? Are you reframing where you want to go now, or is it a continuation of the same pattern of work?
Well, first of all, of course, a discovery like the discovery of Higgs boson was a great, great emotion and a great, injected a lot of enthusiasm in all of us, in particular, of course, in the youngest generations. It was a great time. Clearly, this discovery gives us a new object, a new particle to study, so we will have to study it in all details, measure its properties, the way it interacts with the other particles, so this is clearly one line of research. But in parallel, we will continue to explore those avenues and those aspects of the program, of the LHC program, that we have already started to explore in parallel to the Higgs boson search. I mean, the Large Hadron Collider has been built to address questions for which we don't have an answer. The origin of the particle masses is related to the Higgs boson. Now we have at least a partial answer. But there were others, the origin of the dark matter of the universe, the origin of the matter-antimatter asymmetry, the existence of various families of particles, etc. So we will continue to investigate those important questions.
My name is Tejinder Verdi. I'm a professor of physics at Imperial College, and I have been working on the CMS experiment since its inception, and I was the spokesperson during the years just before data taking started. The meeting is entitled Before, Behind, and Beyond the Discovery of the Higgs boson. Now, this is quite an interesting one because the time span is about 30 years. So the first thoughts about the LHC were expressed in the early 1980s. And in early 1990s, we started thinking about the experiments and the accelerator. And these are really marvels of technology, in fact. And they took a lot of effort to build. At the time we started thinking about the experiments, we didn't really know how to do them. And so we've discovered this Higgs boson, which is a great achievement. It's perhaps the most significant scientific discovery of this century so far. Now, the idea of the meeting was to actually bring together this long history of the experiment and the accelerator and to put them into context. So there were discussions yesterday which looked at the genesis of the project and all the difficulties that entailed, and also the construction of the experiments and the accelerator and all the difficulties that entailed, and also looking at the lots of people, because each of the experiments had about 3,000 people working on them. And most of them are actually young. Each one has about 1,000 PhD students. And so a lot of the work for the discovery has been done by the PhD students. And so the idea was to actually look back and look at the present and also look into the future. Now, we found a Higgs boson from known physics. It's very difficult to understand why we found this Higgs boson in the mass range explored by the LHC. This boson is a very special object. It's not like any other fundamental particle we've discovered so far. And we don't quite understand why its mass is so low, because known physics tells us its mass should be very, very high. And so we can only really conclude that there is new physics beyond the Standard Model. This boson completes the Standard Model, but we know that there is physics beyond the Standard Model. This is something which we already knew 20 years ago when we designed the experiments, that if we did find the Higgs boson, next question would be, why is its mass so low? Now, there are very many conjectures as to what the new physics should be, and one of the more elegant conjectures is supersymmetry. It's a very elegant principle that all matter particles are related to force particles, and so this gives a quite an interesting and elegant description of nature, and it has very many consequences. The lightest of this species of new particles, so every particle would have a super partner, as we call it, and the lightest of this could be a particle that is responsible for dark matter. So this discovery actually opens a portal to new physics in some senses, and this new physics would allow us to understand the universe in more detail than we have been able to do so far, in a deeper understanding, in a sense. And so it's quite an interesting era coming up. The energy of the LHC is going to be doubled when we come back next year, and that really is something which in a sense resets the experiments, because the particles we'll be looking for have masses which are rather high, higher than we've explored so far. And for heavy particles, having a higher energy actually means that you produce them in much more abundance than we've been able to do so far, by a factor of 30 to 100. So it's as if we're restarting a new experiment, and we're hoping to make discoveries of what lies beyond the Standard Model when we come back. And a lot of us are very excited by the startup, just as much as we were when we first started up a few years ago. So it's very interesting times ahead of us.
That was Professor Tejinder Verdi telling us about the next steps for the Large Hadron Collider. If you'd like to listen to the complete audio from before, behind and beyond the discovery of the Higgs boson, it's available on the Royal Society website.
And while you're on the website, why not check out which upcoming events take your fancy? Now, communicating science is something we're really passionate about here at the Royal Society. Every year we award the Michael Faraday Prize to a scientist or engineer whose expertise in communicating scientific ideas in lay terms is outstanding.
In January, this year's winner, Professor Frank Close, was presented the award and delivered a fascinating lecture here at the Royal Society. Here, he tells us all about our asymmetric universe and why he thinks science communication matters.
I'm Frank Close, I'm a physicist. I'm at the Royal Society today to give the Faraday Prize lecture, and the official title is The Asymmetric Universe. I've been calling it on Twitter the lopsided universe because it's one character less, and actually I'm going to refer to the unsymmetric universe, and please accept my apologies now for ruining the English language, but there's a reason for it.
First, if you could just tell me what you'll be talking about today, what is the asymmetric universe?
Well, I'm going to mention what symmetry is, like balance and harmony, you know it when you see it, and that we like to think that nature is symmetric. We appeal to symmetry when we try to come up with theories, but actually most of nature is not symmetric. Most things are quite lopsided. Sometimes you find things that are symmetric, and at first sight obviously so, have hidden surprises. So the example of that I'm going to give is atoms, that everybody is held together by electrical forces, but there's no spare electricity left over, that the negative charges of the electrons in the outside of the atom and the positive charges in the middle exactly balance each other. Now, if you're an accountant, you'd say, well, that's easy. I mean, it's just plus one here, minus one there, it all cancels out. But it's subtle, because the hydrogen atom, the simplest of all, the electron on the outside carries the negative. And as far as we know, the electron is one of the basic letters of nature's alphabet. There's nothing smaller than it. The proton, however, is a complicated beast. It's made of little things called quarks. And these quarks, on the average, carry one-third electrical charges, and they cluster together in threes, never twos or fours. So straight away there, we've actually come to a question at the frontier of understanding. Why does electrical charge balance so perfectly? The electron and the quarks presumably must somehow know about each other.
Why is symmetry important? Why does it matter if things are symmetric or not symmetric? and why is that interesting to scientists?
I think psychologically, we all recognize symmetry when we see it. We recognize beauty and pattern when we see them. And there's some deep psychological feeling that symmetry is a guide to nature. And symmetry arises in mathematics. And if there are symmetrical patterns in the mathematics, you have a feeling that this is perhaps on the right track. But other than the fact that it seems to work, I don't know that there is any fundamental reason why it should be like that. And what I'm actually going to say is that when you have symmetry, there are two types. There's symmetry that is stable and will stay there forever. Like if you've got a cup and you put a ball in the bottom of the cup, it will stay there forever. But if you turn the cup over, if it's got a hemispherical base and you try to balance a ball on the top of that, it'll roll off at some random angle. And so although nature might like symmetry, it's stability that rules. The trump card is nature's golden rule is things want to be as stable as possible. So you might start off with what I call unstable symmetry, the ball on the top of the cup, and you end up with stable unsymmetry. That's why I'm ruining the English language. So there's a sort of symmetry in the way that I'm using the words. But that seems to be a golden rule, and there are many examples all around, and the theme of the lecture really is it's all over the place. I certainly know that it's the key to the idea that Peter Higgs shared the Nobel Prize for this year. It might also have something to do with the fact that the universe, which as far as symmetry is concerned, ought to be equally populated by matter and antimatter. Matter seems to win out everywhere. Antimatter is absent, so that's something that has disappeared. That might be an example that matter and antimatter, although perfectly symmetric, is highly unstable. They would just annihilate each other. A small excess, where small means everything that we now know, is the stable unsymmetry that we're left with. Whether this also applies at the level of DNA, which all seems to call in the same direction, that the mirror image is not used by living things. There's a reason for that. I don't know what it is. I don't know if anybody knows what it is. But this might be another example that over the eons, evolution, that having both left-handed and right-handed, in order to procreate, you've got to find somebody with the same-handedness. And so just the efficiency of evolution might have caused the stable unsymmetry of it all going in one direction. And there are other examples that I'll show in the talk.
Thank you for telling us about your lecture. So you're giving the lecture because you've won this year's Royal Society Faraday Prize for Excellence in Science Communication. Why do you think science communication is important, and why do you enjoy doing it?
Why is it important? Well, there's many answers to that. I suppose at a political level, science needs funding and support, and it is important to make the taxpayers, who after all ultimately are funding science, aware of what their tax money is going towards. That science isn't just for the jollification of scientists. It has a great relevance to society. It's also for the younger people, who will be the next generation of scientists, to excite them to the wonders of the universe. Why is it that I enjoy communicating science? It's because, in a sense, I sort of have a sense of guilt, which is that, you know, as a child, a young baby is trying to make sense of the universe, and they ask questions. Some of us continue asking questions, and that's what scientists are. They are always wanting to know why or know deeper. And then I feel very lucky that actually I've spent my career being paid to be a scientist. I'm still amazed at the beauty of nature. And most recently, when the Higgs boson was discovered, the emotional aspect of this, that 50 years ago, Peter Higgs and several others were scribbling equations on a piece of paper, and somehow, in a very profound way, these equations know the universe, even before we did. 50 years later, an experiment is done which shows the universe really works like those equations said. And this is very profound. And we were all watching when the announcement was made that they'd finally discovered the boson. And many of us were crying because it was quite an overwhelming feeling that somehow, you know, we know nature. And I want to share that with people. I suppose that's the thing that drives me towards doing that.
Professor Close's full lecture was characteristically fascinating, fitting for an expert science communicator. It's definitely worth watching in full on our website.
Now, think of magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, and you'll probably imagine a hospital patient receiving scans to produce detailed images of inside their body. It's an incredibly useful way of looking at everything from heart disease to brain activity.
But Professor Lynn Gladden has a new spin on the technique, which takes MRI out of the medical arena and into the world of chemistry on a large scale, using it to answer some fundamental questions about chemical mixing and reactivity. We found out more when we caught up with her ahead of her public lecture.
My name's Lynn Gladden, and I'm a Professor of Chemical Engineering at the University of Cambridge.
Okay, so you're here tonight to do the Bakerian Lecture 2014, and your lecture title is It's Magnetic Resonance, But Not As You Know It. So can you just give us a bit of an outline as to what you're going to be talking about tonight?
Well, I thought it was a sensible title, since when most people think about magnetic resonance imaging, they think about the MRI technique that you come across in hospitals, and most of us have encountered them or know of them in some form. And really what we've been doing in my research group over the past 15 years or so is to take exactly the same measurement technique, the big superconducting magnet. Often we'll have that magnet in a vertical orientation as opposed to a horizontal one. And then put scaled down versions, or sometimes real size versions, of chemical process units inside the magnetic field. And so you're substituting the human body with a piece of a chemical plant, essentially, and then trying to understand the internal structures of that process unit, just as you would look at the internal structures of the body and any of the flow processes that are occurring within it.
What would you say your biggest challenge has been from transplanting the technology from the medical arena into the sort of engineering field?
Well, the biggest challenge is a technical challenge, in the sense that our bodies are all very high water content, and most of the materials that our body's made up of behave in a rather similar fashion to the radio frequency field that's used in the magnetic resonance experiment. When you move away from biological systems into engineering systems, then you're starting to look at materials which may respond quite differently to the radio frequency, and therefore you have to be much more precise at times about the way you implement the so-called pulse sequences, which are the NMR experiment itself.
Before you got into scientific research, you had plans to sort of get into a teaching career, I think that's right. So what was it about scientific research that sort of drew you in?
Well, after I did my PhD, I still intended to go back and teach. But I did get interested in research, very interested in research, while I was a graduate student. And then actually it was an award from the Royal Society, which gave me a 5-year fellowship, a Pickering Fellowship. And so I got that award. And then really a few months later was then offered a faculty position, a lectureship in the chemical engineering department at the university. So I thought, why not? Let's have a go and see what this is like. And it has been great fun.
What would you say the future challenges in your field are, and how you're placed to tackle those?
I think there are two main challenges. One is to be able to apply the techniques we've developed under relevant process conditions. So that means at high temperature, high pressure. Most of the chemical processes that exist will operate under high temperature pressure conditions. And so that's a technical challenge of actually building high pressure temperature units that operate inside the magnet system, and then making sure that our techniques still work well in those environments, which they should do. So the challenge is more about building the process environments. The other challenge is to start to take magnetic resonance measurements away from just being laboratory experiments and getting them to work on what we would call low field technology, so cheap permanent magnets which could sit on a desk, could go into research and development labs in companies. And then you have those methods haven't been used traditionally because you can get very little signal from them, because the magnetic field is low and the signal to noise you get from a measurement correlates with the strength of the magnetic field. But with some of the techniques that are being developed in our group and in other groups around the world now, we may be able to open up some magnetic resonance measurements applications in low field technology. Some of that's begun to happen. Classic example for many years has been what's called well logging in the hydrocarbon recovery area.
That was Professor Lynn Gladden explaining some exciting developments in chemical imaging. And if her introduction to the subject has piqued your interest, you can watch the recording of her 2014 Bakerian lecture on the Royal Society website.
Sadly, the Our Science podcast is almost at an end, but before we head off, we'll hear again from Professor Frank Close on a question we love to pose every episode: why science?
We all appreciate the beauty of the rainbow. We can see it with our eyes. Scientists are lucky that they are able to use instruments that can extend their vision to the very far reaches of the universe, like in astronomy with telescopes, right down to the smallest structure of matter, which is the field that I work in particle physics. And you find beautiful wonders at all scales. And so people who have not had the opportunity to extend their vision have missed out a wonderful panorama that nature offers. And so for science, for scientists, to be able to revel in the beauty of nature and then to understand, why is it like this? Does it have to be like this? How does it all work? When you discover the equations of maths describe the universe, you have an eerie feeling that somehow you're really about to touch the secret of it all. It's always slightly out of reach. And that's really what makes science fascinating. It's always just slightly out of reach.
That's it for this week. If you want to find out more about upcoming talks and events, remember you can find them all on our website at royalsociety.org/events.
And you can keep track of all the latest news by following at Royal Society on Twitter or searching for the Royal Society on Facebook. Thanks for listening.